Welcome to Scotch Friday podcast and our special series on the role of youth in the pursuit of social justice. My name is Martin Downey, and I'm your guest host and moderator for this discussion. Most of us have heard about the tragic events captured on video when last month in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on May 25th, during an arrest for allegedly using a counterfeit bill, George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, died as a result of a white officer kneeling on his neck while handcuffed and lying face down, while repeatedly begging for his life, saying, "I can't breathe." The death of George Floyd triggered spontaneous protests and a resumption of the Black Lives Matter movement all over the USA and around the globe. Even our quiet bedroom community of Burlington, with a population just under 200,000, got involved. Earlier this month, on the 4th of June, it is estimated that about 5,000 people, mostly young people, marched to our city hall in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. On that note, we've gathered a notable group of people here this evening to discuss this issue. So to begin, I'd like to introduce Carmel Sacrin, who is the host of Scotch Fridays, managing lawyer as well at Green, Gurman, and Sacrin Law Office. He's also a youth director of the Rotary Club of Burlington. Andrew Sesse, originally from Sierra Leone, is currently pursuing a master's degree in comparative education in Zhejiang, I know I might do that, Zhejiang, China. Andrew has worked with various organizations and has developed a knowledge of diversity and takes pride in interacting with many people, irrespective of age, gender, race, and ethnicity. Rita Scott, as a lawyer, has practiced criminal law with a focus on restorative justice in Aboriginal communities. She was also an adjudicator for the independent assessment hearing to decide claims by former residents of Indian residential schools. Rajiv Weiching Sahab, an avid travel enthusiast, he has visited approximately 70 countries thus far in his young life. As a Rotary volunteer, he has spent time involved with Rotary's Youth Exchange Program, as well as his current role as assistant governor. Previously, he was president of the Rotary Club of Mississauga West. Renee Papin, a longtime resident of Burlington, the home of Scotch Friday podcasts, is also an active member of Rotary Club of Central Burlington, as well as a board member of the Hamilton Halton United Way. Peter Dinsdale is president and CEO of YMCA Canada, working to create the YMCA we want through the YMCA we need. Formerly the CEO of the Assembly of First Nations, as well as being a recipient of the Order of Ontario, awarded for his public service work. Please know that all of the panelists' full bios are located on our Scotch Friday website. Feel free to browse through there at any time after this broadcast. Now, as we've said at the beginning, this is a special presentation on youth and social justice, and we have a few questions that we want to kick off with to get this conversation underway. And I'm going to start by posing this one, and feel free, any of you, to kindly jump in and offer your thoughts. Do the youth of today, with their powerful social media tools that allows them to immediately mobilize, in effect, give them control of the social justice agenda? Rita, you feel like you have something on your mind about that point, this point in time?
No, I'll hold my fire for the moment.
Okay, we can't wait. Renee, looks like you're ready to say something here.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that the youth have really been the catalyst in terms of mobilizing people to get them on the street. From what I've witnessed, there seems to be a very young group, and then there's a bit of a older adult group that has been doing a lot of leading. When you look at the those people that hold microphones and those types of things in the organization, but I think the social aspect and social media tools to corral all of these people into one spot to be able to control them peacefully. I mean, there was a lot of unrest in the early days, but that seems to have abated. Other than, you know, last Saturday. But I think that the whole thing is that they brought the agenda front and to the public. And now we need to figure out a way to make it work in terms of logistics on how we're going to change how policing is being done in North America.
Indeed, it would seem that this has been a real catalyst for a couple of different conversations. As you say, one of them, of course, is the fact that there's youth speaking as loudly as they are to make the impact that they're making. At the same time, it, of course, brings back the whole Black Lives Matter movement to the forefront, which had sort of dulled a little bit over the last couple of years. And then furthermore, introduces a whole new subject matter, really, that has been talked about in certain circles, but perhaps nowhere near as much as it is right now. And that's the whole question of how police forces function around North America, at least perhaps around the world, for that matter. But to come back to the question, are they in control? Is really the issue. In other words, does this method they have of social media, method of communication, does that kind of control the pace and the statements and the sentiment overall versus other interest groups and you know, people within society that can say, wait a minute, some might say, hey, youth is wasted on the young. What do they know? You know, but in reality, we've seen in the past how youth has mobilized various other parts of society over the years. So it's really an interesting kind of phenomenon to see the kind of impact they're having right now. But are they the only ones really pushing it that way? Andrew, any thoughts at that point from your side?
Yeah, I will come in from there. First, I want to look at the issue of justice, the issue of fairness, and the issue of justness. Because talking of youth and talking of the rampage on the streets, the concern is, are they really in control? Are their voices being heard? What they are asking for, is somebody listening to them? We might, in one other thought, say they are not. In some other thoughts, we can say, yes, they are listened to. Because we have seen different audios of prominent people replying to some of these Black Lives Movement matter. And some of these audios has been positive because what they are asking for, so many people are saying it's a right and they deserve it. In relation to that, we know that social justice has to do with how best people are treated fairly and justly based on different parameters. And these parameters could be issues that have to do with fair distribution of wealth of a nation, fair distribution of opportunities, and fair distribution of social privileges. And when once people are denied of these ones, most times you see that they want their voices to be heard. And we always have to remember that the youth, they are a population of energy. Because of the energy they have, they will be the ones always to go on the streets and ask for justice and ask for opportunities and ask for privileges. But I think in all, their voices are being heard because I have listened to so many audios, so many videos of police officers, government officials, you know, saying at least they should be listened to. So I believe their voices have been heard.
That's good to know, of course, that is the case, because obviously that's why they're there, and it seems like an appropriate time to say, well, hopefully, you know, somebody's going to get through on some of these what seem like, you know, very dead-end conversations otherwise that are not going anywhere, have not gone anywhere. Are we seeing that in other areas, though, as well as just the Black Lives Movement issue? For instance, again, back to perhaps Peter, the Aboriginal youth of our society, here in Canada at least, have suffered equally as many injustices in many respects over the years. Are we seeing them joining forces here and saying the same things, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple things. First, I think certainly Indigenous people want to give space to the Black Lives Matter movement for its own. They don't need to usurp that movement or compare historical injustice, I would say. So I've seen a lot of folks in my social media stream being very respectful of that and making room for Black voices to share their experiences. And I would think, you know, to answer maybe the first question more fulsomely, it depends what we mean by youth, whether or not we think youth are running or driving this. I mean, in Canada, 20% of the Canadian population is between the ages of 15 and 29, like one fifth of our population. And if you think of the time in your life when you're going to rebel against power structures, you're going to rebel against historical injustice, if you're going to rebel against everything you see wrong in society, it is this age group. And there's no question this age group has grown up with such high levels of digital literacy, the ability to coordinate campaigns and engage campaigns. And I would actually say these current social justice movements wouldn't exist without youth. They are the spirit of these movements. You remove youth from these protests and you have lack of energy, you have the lack of imagination, and really the lack of will, I think, to invite the existing power structures the way that it has. So I think it's impossible to have these protests without the spirit and energy of youth, including Indigenous youth. That, you know, and again, I don't want to take away from the Black Lives Matter and the existing moment that we're in. But I was at the Assembly of First Nations during Idle No More. It was our youth that were demanding reclamation of traditional governance systems. It was the youth demanding reconciliation. It was the youth demanding these things and standing on the front line. So I'm not surprised at all, nor that would be my expectation, that youth would lead them all.
That's a really good point to make about the fact that without their energy and their drive, there's a good chance that guys my age would sit back and go, well, okay, yes, I'll write a letter, but am I going to wave a banner and walk in the protest? I'm not so sure. However, I should be as mobilized as they are, given the cause and the need for that kind of justification to be had. Where do we think we're going to succeed in doing this? In other words, what kind of changes are we looking for? Are the youth of today looking for in that sense? Any thoughts on that, Rita?
Well, I was just thinking that, you know, there's been a lot of questions asked of a lot of people lately, being interviewed and asking, how is this different than previous protests and things? And I think that the reason this is different is because of social media and because of youth, because it moves so fast. And it has really captured what youth have to say. And, you know, when we ask questions about where are we going from here, or what would be the next step, or any of those kinds of questions, my response to that really is, well, let's just watch them and see what it is, because out of this last series of protests over the last couple of weeks, we have seen amazing change happening, with police chiefs resigning and various leaders of authoritarian groups stepping down and acknowledging that things have gone horrendously wrong and have never been rectified. And I think that whole demand for, you know, defund the police or rework the whole way that emergency services are delivered in a community. I mean, we're having that conversation here in my community, and talking about all of those kinds of changes that youth have spearheaded in this protest. And it's happened, and it's become known as quickly as it has because of social media and the fact that youth know how to use it. And, you know, you were talking about your little bedroom community of 200,000 people. Creston is 5,000 people, and we had a protest yesterday at the town hall. We must have had 200 people out. That's a big protest. And both of our Black residents of Creston got up and spoke, both of them very young, one 12 years old and the other a young man in his 20s. And the crowd was very largely Aboriginal, and then a huge mix of just about everybody, every age group you can imagine. The only people that were not there were the real nasties that have been on Facebook disparaging the Black Lives Movement and and being horrendously negative. They did not turn out for this, and the crowd was amazing and so supportive. And when I think about how that happened, we've had all kinds of issues that have arisen in the community that have never had the leadership and the voice that this little protest yesterday had. And it has flooded our Facebook all over our community in Creston conversations and all of that kind of stuff. It's all because young people have brought it up. Our LGBTQ group, our young Aboriginal folks, they absolutely led the protest yesterday. And I just think that without that, we would not be at the place where we're talking about how can policing be different than it has been in the past. That has come from youth. And I just think that what we need to do is sit back, listen, and watch and see where this is going, because I think youth have a really good grip on it.
That's really quite a very keen perspective there, Rita. I think you're very right about the fact that there may very well be a perspective there that we don't see otherwise and haven't seen in other events in the past. Because one interesting thing you touched on there was the mixture of races and peoples of different walks of life, if you will, who have been out protesting. It's been noted in the press even among the various protests within the U.S. that these aren't just Black Lives Matter type groups of people stepping out.
Sorry, Martin, your voice is too low.
I'm not sure what's going on there, happened or changed.
That's better.
Maybe I was just fading. I apologize. it's interesting to note, and I'm not sure how much you caught there of that, but how much these protests have had mixed individuals within their groups on the street. It's not strictly a Black Lives Matter event. It's often filled with white people and many others, right? So that's a very keen perspective, if you will, on how youth may very well have had a much greater impact today, particularly in conjunction with social media and the way it can spread the word that much more quickly than comparatively speaking to events in the past when social media didn't exist and things took a lot longer to spread around the news cycle, so to speak. So it's kind of really a strong statement that what they're asking for is actually starting to show some signs of progress so quickly. And if that's the case, then that means momentum has been perhaps gained already. I'm going to jump to Rajiv here because I got to think with all the travel that he's done globally, there's got to be perhaps some perspective from your part, Rajiv, on what you see or what you might know of happening in other parts of the world, because this has become a global event, which in itself is really quite unique compared to other events here in North America. So what do you think is going on and why in terms of this elsewhere in the world?
Martin, to answer that, I would draw on my experience as the district chair of Rotary's Youth Exchange Program, where we exchange with several countries. And it was very interesting to watch. These are high school age youth, 15 to 17. It was very interesting to watch their take on some of the social problems that we're encountering. And a lot of them had a couple of things in common. One of them is that, they were tired of being told, sorry, Carmel, louder?
That's good.
Okay, sorry. One of them was that they wanted to see more immediate results. They did have an appreciation of they had there's decorum, there's due process, but they always had this frustration that things get stuck in a bureaucracy or in a process, and that was always a frustration that I found was common to them. And I think what we've seen is that they have achieved a great deal, even in the short term. Some very significant conversations are happening. when I hear defund the police, now of course there's a great thing, number of things that means, not just defunding the police, but more redirecting some resources to help with, you know, mental health, right. Social work, etc. But a year ago, looking at the system currently, several of us might have thought that this is a radical change.
That's right.
But it's here. It's here, and it's here because the youth, I would say largely the youth, pushed that envelope, made their expectations heard, and continued.
Yes, it is quite something to think that, as you say, a year ago, somebody said defund the police, we wouldn't say, well, are you crazy? That's a crazy notion. But on the other hand, you have these extreme examples right here in Canada alone, where a wellness check was attended by police in Edmonton, Brunswick, last week, and the young person they went to check on ended up dead. That kind of thing is probably what we're talking about when we hear about defund the police. It's reassigning these calls to the appropriate service people to call on, not somebody who's necessarily going to react with drawing a gun. So it's a really incredible, vital role that needs to be put in place. And this movement seems to be helping to direct that forward in that way, which is really encouraging, because given what Rita said a few months ago as well, I think this starting to teach me at least the thought that, hey, maybe we really have something wrong here, because some of us who are as old as I am at least will remember that these various movements sometimes in the past have absolutely gone nowhere. And a lot of it is, as you say, Rajiv, because things do get bogged down in due process and laws have to be written and so on, and that takes forever. There seems to be something going on here that may be similar even to what took place when COVID struck. Suddenly, everything was like, you know, government money was suddenly available. Don't worry about it. Go do it. Done. Right? We'll worry about the details later. Maybe that has some impetus here. Do we think the two situations aligning themselves the way they have has actually encouraged this level of momentum to be gained, I wonder?
I would definitely agree. I mean, I think that the whole fact that we were in a pandemic and everything slowed down, I think I'm repeating myself, but everything slowed down where people were, in their homes, they were watching TV, and that 9 minutes that when that came across, so many more people saw it because they weren't out doing other things. And it created a huge reaction right across the United States. And I mean, going back to this problem with police officers, you're sending out police officers to situations where they are willing to use deadly force in a confrontation that doesn't necessarily require deadly force. And that's the bottom line. And that's now been brought to the focus of everybody through the power of the youth, because if they hadn't been doing these demonstrations, none of this would have happened in terms of looking at what's happened. Look at the two Indigenous individuals that were killed with deadly force. They didn't have to shoot, in my opinion, shoot somebody. The guy that was running away, drunk, who just wanted to run home, and if they'd let him go, he could have walked down the street 10 minutes and picked him up at his house. But no, the guy has to pull out a gun and shoot him in the back 3 times. Like, it's just unbelievable. I saw a guy today get arrested riding his bicycle, and the police said, "We're arresting you because you do not have a bell on your bike."
Arresting.
They arrested him, put him in handcuffs, and took him to the police station.
Isn't that just typically a fine that you get written a ticket for?
Yeah. No, but he got handcuffed, and he kept saying, "You're arresting me because I don't have a bell on my bike."
Well, then I wonder, is there...
I better put a bell on mine. Because I don't have a pair of handcuffs that'll fit my wrist.
Is there a fear there, and Carmel, maybe you should jump in on this, is there a fear there, perhaps, that with the advent of all of this protesting going on, that some of those folks on the opposite side of those protests, the ones who do have to, you know, put on a gun every day and go to work and beyond that, are actually reacting maybe negatively towards this and not embracing this the way we are?
Well, look, I think that 99.9% of police officers do their job exceptionally well. And it only takes one person to make that group look bad. And so, you know, we don't want to whitewash or broad brush any organization. And we have a great regard and respect for the rule of law in Canada. And that is the premise of our democratic society. Without police officers, then who's going to do the monitoring and enforcement? So that's just a shout out to them. But I have a bigger concern. And my concern is that we do have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms where our equality rights are specified. You know, look at Section 15. It's very clear that no one is above the law and you shall not be discriminated against based on your race, national or ethnic origin, color, religion, sex, age, or mental or physical disability. And there's more to that charter. But when we talk about social justice, we're talking about this other parallel existence. So you have your rights, which are constitutionally enshrined. And in the US, they have a constitution too. But it's trying to make sure that our culture, our society lives up to the expectations of social justice. And with youth, my only comment would be that, you know, youth have short attention spans, I'm sorry to say, or they tend to reflect that, maybe because they're bombarded with so much on social media. But I don't think most would argue against the fact that youth tend to find things of interest, they get all energized about it, and then it goes away, and then it takes something tragic like a George Floyd video to mobilize them again. My real concern is, how do you take that youth and the energy of the youth and keep it consistent? And so that, for example, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, I mean, we have inquiries here in Canada. I don't know if the state legislature there has ordered an inquiry. I have no idea, but that's where a society really gets challenged, and that is, do you live up to your to the constitutional, the expectations of the Constitution, and how do we get youth to understand that it's not just the flavor of the day, that it has to be a constant thing where their energy is they pursue it in, they don't wait for some tragedy to re-energize them, that we're always on top of that struggle.
Carmel, I'm gonna suggest that Andrew's gonna respond to that. But Andrew, before you do that, I'm coming back to Peter because Peter had a point that I think he'd like to make about the previous comments from Renee.
Yeah, I'll try to be quick and bridge it back. I think the real issue that particularly Indigenous people have, first off, in Canada, there are rights. There's a Charter of Rights and Freedom, but there's still the Indian Act, of which I am governed under. So there's not equality under the law. If I die, my assets, if I don't have a proper will, can be disposed of by the Minister of Indian Affairs. That doesn't exist in your life today, nor the ability for me to live in certain territories with that status card. That doesn't exist with the rest of society today. So systemic racism is real and is legislated in Canada and it exists. So I think that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing around this is the RCMP budget, 40% of it, or $3.1 billion, is in contract and Indigenous policing. Indigenous people make 4% of the Canadian population. $3.1 billion to police 4% of the population. So the real issue is the paramilitary nature of policing on Indigenous peoples in particular. You have to look no farther than pipeline protests or Idle No More protests to see who do they send in first. It is paramilitary police officers dressed like elite commandos to come in and break up constitutionally protected rights to protest. The other issue I would say is Canada has something called the Integrated Threat Assessment Center that was made after 9/11 to coordinate threats to national security. That center was used to monitor protest events such as shutting down Highway 401 in support of reconciliation and demanding actions on treaties, which are not threats to national security. They might be criminal, but they're not threats to national security. So defund the police, I think this energy and spirit comes from the paramilitary nature of how these police forces have been used, particularly against indigenous people. You mentioned a bunch of them doing a safety check and someone ends up killed. That is using state authority and state control, which ended result in the death of a person. Same thing as running over that man up in Nunavut, opening the RCMP door, knocking him down. All that stuff is the actions of a paramilitary police. No one disagrees with community policing. No one disagrees with the need for justice in communities. But it's the paramilitary nature of it, I think, really throws people off. And again, I would challenge the assertion that equality in Canada is guaranteed. And we just need to fight harder for those rights, because people have been fighting for generations for those rights. And those are the kinds of ways that they're met.
So that's some powerful stuff there, Peter.
Yeah, and I think the one of the ways to actually verbalize that is that the fact is that the state has weaponized the judicial system against the Indigenous people. And you know, that is exactly what they've done. I mean, it's just I'm almost speechless now. Like, you know, it's intolerable.
You know, the kind of social change that we really perhaps need to study here in Canada, at least, is much more directed towards Indigenous people. I think that's probably been true in other parts of the world, too. Other colonized countries have met with that same issue, problem, places like Australia, for instance, perhaps. But to come back to the point that Carmel was making, I really kind of want to hear from Andrew on this notion that youth have the energy. They have the drive, the motivation to be the catalyst in these changes that we all are recommending and suggesting really need to be changed and addressed immediately, at this country at least, and perhaps certainly elsewhere in the world. But Andrew, tell me, do you concur that really youth sometimes have a kind of a fizzling out kind of impact? How do they sustain it? For instance, how do we emphasize the importance to them of getting involved in the political process and voting on a regular basis, among other things?
Thank you. Like I said, with youth, it always has to do with, like Kamal said, the decision. They make a decision so fast, because like when they watch those videos, as an elderly somebody, it will take you time to decide what to do next. But with youth, they are so emotional that they react so soon, and maybe later they might regret their reactions. But the good thing is, like he was saying, the laws are there. They are specified in the document. These are your rights, these are your responsibilities. But these laws are supposed to be enforced by law enforcement agencies and officers. But they themselves are not enforcing the laws correctly. And once they go against those laws, or when once they miss the track of enforcing those laws, you see the spillover effect. And the spillover effect is people will react, people will comment, people will ask questions. It's like you say, and I have a right to talk. Then when I talk, you say I should not talk. I will react. I will tell you that I have a freedom to talk. Why are you asking me not to talk? So when once these laws are there in the document, the enforcement is also relevant and very important. When once we missed the track to enforce these laws, the spillover effect is always not good. With youth and political, it's like drawing a board, a dichotomy. You know, the good thing is the youth, they are like the future, because they have to take over. Whatever they are fighting for today, you know, they are fighting because of their future, because it has to do with them in the future. It's like we are fighting for justice today. We are fighting for Black Lives Matter today. Tomorrow, they will say, yes, I was part of that fight. Yes, we are able to achieve this. So those coming after us may not face that type of situation again. It's like in your youthful age, there are issues you fought for in your youthful age. Today, those issues are not there again. You can say, yes, I was part of that movement some years back. We fought for this and we are able to achieve it. And today, people are not suffering from it. And that is exactly what they are doing now. Because they have seen that it has gone out of hand. It has become so much so that people are being humiliated, whether because of race, whether because of culture, whether because of resources. If we don't stop it now, it may continue in the future, which means even our children, yet unborn, may come and suffer such a type of thing. So I think with our political institutions, with our law enforcement institutions, what they are supposed to do is, maybe they are supposed to go back to those laws and make sure that those laws are meant for everybody, not for a separate entity, not for a separate group of people. If you say we have a freedom to talk, that freedom cuts across everybody, despite your race, despite your culture, despite your sex. If you say there is a freedom of movement, it should be meant for everybody, but not for a separate class. When once you start to put people in class, there is always a spillover effect of why me? Why am I put here and these ones are here? Why am I given less opportunities and others are given more opportunities? Why am I given less privileges while others are given more? So if it's a law, it should be for all, not for few.
You've been listening to a special series on social justice. Join our panel next time as they continue this conversation here on Scotch Fridays. Tune in next week when our panel concludes their conversation with their observations on the power of youth to make positive change. My name is Martin Downey. Thank you for listening. Please remember to leave your comments at www.scotchfridays.ca. Until next week, be safe and thank you for listening.